Good afternoon. On the part of the Integrative Complementary and Traditional Health Practice section, I would love to welcome you to this afternoon. I'm Beth Summers, and for about 24 more hours, I will be chair of this section. Then I will graduate to becoming immediate past chair. I don't think our next chair, Ann Doherty, is here right now, but hopefully you will get a chance to meet her. And then our chair-elect, Prasad Vinjamuri, is sitting in the back. So we are delighted to have you all here. You know, from a historical perspective, 10 or 15 years ago, maybe we'd talk about integrative care. Here in APHA, we'd talk about alternative care. And then there'd be another group talking about health policy. And everyone was speaking in a different language. So the fact that we actually have this session today in the program is really a major triumph. And we are really fortunate to have some top-notch speakers. Unfortunately, in your program, there's one speaker, Devaki, who will not be here today, but we will be able to have a chance to talk about national and international policy of integrative health approaches. So initially, I want to describe and welcome our invited speaker, who we are very excited about. He is truly a friend to integrative health practices of all sorts. Just to briefly outline his many achievements, he has been working in integrative health for 32 years as a chronicler, speaker, organizer, and executive. If you love the Integrator blog, like I do, you count on his perspective and his connections with many people from around the world. He contributes as well to many, many columns. He consults nationally with organizations like the NIH, internationally with organizations like the World Health Organization, and he has helped create or direct multi-stakeholder initiatives that include organizations like the Integrative Health Policy Consortium and the Academic Consortium for Complementary and Alternative Healthcare. He has 4 honorary doctorates. He would definitely be welcome in our session at any time. I'm going to say one more thing about him, but before that, this session, in part because of his work, as well as our other 2 presenters, has been endorsed by various other bodies within APHA, in particular, the Committee on Women's Health Rights and the Socialist Caucus. So you know you're in good company here. And if you're in any of the following sections, you can actually get credit, continuing medical education. If you're in the medical section, health education, nursing, or public health, keep track of that. So I think this is a tremendous gathering here. If there were a Nobel Prize for someone who has taken integrative health approaches out of concierge medicine and spas and brought it to communities, it is John Weeks. He is our Nobel laureate, and I want to introduce him and let you hear his words.
Beth and I have a mutual adoration society. I've been a follower of her work from Pathways through working here and actually through ACAC. And Beth actually arranged for her to be a bridge to our work with the Academic Consortium. And we both have had a relationship to global advances in health and medicine as well. So a real pleasure to be here. My spouse wears the MPH in the family, but through her and through my own passions, I feel like connected. And this has been an 18-year-old in freshman year who's looking at all the courses that you can take at the university. These couple of days here, it's just been really fun spreading out, you know, opening up my mind and learning new things. So wonderful to be here. Get myself organized. So what I plan to do is bring you all through some of the history of really looking at the kind of the economic integration issues, but the broader integration issues, and it's thinking more about the provider side than and the values, but to see that in the context of the shift that's happening in regular delivery of care. I'm focusing on the U.S. here mostly. We're going to look at where opportunities may be opening up and in what areas for a deeper level of actual integration, since roughly in 93-95 is when this era of integration kind of began in the U.S. And then I'll discuss a project that I've worked with through the Academic Consortium for Complementary and Alternative Healthcare and their Center for Optimal Integration. It's a project there. I'll be talking about that and what its intent is and what that resource might be for you. I talk about alignment of interest a lot. I don't have conflict of interest of anybody, but I'm involved with a lot of different organizations, sometimes paid, sometimes as an advisor, sometimes on an editorial board, sometimes as a writer, and that gives you a little bit of a flavor of that, but it means that some of the people I'm talking about, I have some relationship to. I'm not going to allude to them all the time when it comes up, but none of them are for-profit payment by a pharma company, a dietary supplement company, or any other business interest. So I started in this field in 83. I'm not a practitioner. And it was an era before there was an NIH interest in this area, and I was articulating to a broader community. My job was to actually raise money for what was then called John Bastier College of Naturopathic Medicine. In Seattle, it was unknown. Naturopathic medicine was on the school, unknown. The school was unknown. My job was to help build bridges in the community, eventually try to get money from the community to support the development effort there. And to do that, I needed to know something about evidence, right? So I would listen to people and ask them questions about where are you good, right? What do you do well, and what kind of impact that could be useful to the community, to community health? And these are the kind of what I call the hot tub claims, because you'd hear about them. Somebody would be bragging about something they did particularly well with a certain patient, and they kind of would fall into these. You know, my people are more functional. They can do more things after they see me, right? They aren't in as much pain as they used to be. They suffer fewer adverse effects with what I do than what they were doing. They seem to feel that they have more energy. This is the kind of thing that people would say before there was a lot of evidence around whether or not, you know, that was in fact so. The evidence was this one-to-one, or, you know, in my mind then, I would group things. And as a bunch of people would say the same things, then they'd make it on this slide. If you think about the value to the delivery system, then it would fall into sort of, we can diminish use of pharma, we can lower those adverse effects, lower the need for imaging for services, perhaps lower the need for surgeries, and of course, there was a general consensus feeling that we can lower costs. More use of me will lower costs. So that was that's the hot tub claims. This is before we had a lot of evidence. That era really shifted with this study, which I imagine all of you are aware of this, Eisenberg's work in 1893. If you're not, it was a turning point for the field when basically the human use of these providers and these therapies came out of the closet and was made public. Through, and he called it unconventional medicine, but they found that a third plus of adult Americans were using some of these services or practitioners, and 14 billion roughly was being spent mostly out of pocket. It woke up all of the stakeholders. They started thinking differently about where the value might be. Mainly, they began to look at it as a way to access voters, media readers, members of health plans, to draw people into hospitals. It was all about drawing that population and those dollars into the stakeholders. As you will see, in that first period, and this was my integrator hard copy newsletter that I did a poor job of taking a picture of, from the era, But what I was doing, when I to let you know how this field has moved, when I first started writing it, there was a little earlier iteration. It was St. Anthony's Publishing, which, if any of you remember that, they were an old coding publishing company. But the wife of the owner was into complementary alternative medicine. So he said, we should do a newsletter about this thing that's going on. And they asked me if I wanted to chair the advisory council. I said, hey, I'd like to write it, so I have an excuse to call up anybody anytime I want to and ask them what's going on. At the time, they said, do you think there's enough going on to fill 8 pages once a month? I mean, if you think about what's going on today in this area, you really get a sense, a measure of just how far all of this has moved. But what happened and what we ended up learning was the level of integration was basically all non-integration. In insurance, it was carve-outs, right? You pay more for it for an additional benefit. In a hospital or delivery organization, it was a separate integrated center. Poorly integrated with what was going on. They weren't ready to actually look at whether there's value in these things. It was, let's do it to attract consumers, to attract members, to attract in place of employers, you know, to attract in that late 90s with the dot-com run-up, there was a lot of interest from employers. They had these benefits in order to be more competitive in the marketplace. It wasn't a values-based integration. The only value was this one, largely, with an addition of an interest in supporting those patients in some of these systems that cared about this kind of care. There was a misalignment, as we learned. I saw it again, knowing the hot tub claims, we thought that, shoot, now they'll look at how we can help lower costs for insurers. But if you have come to know the insurance industry, anybody here with the insurance industry? It's a cost plus, I learned this on the road while I was reporting it, it's a cost plus operation, basically. So if you can get 25% for your overhead and profit, 25% of $100 is how much? How much is it of 200? 50 bucks, right? So if you have a family policy that costs $1,200 as it was back in the day, and that's moved up to $8,500 or $17,600, what's your 25% worth now? So there's a misaligned incentive with cost savings, right? If you're a hospital who's being run by a CFO with a CFO mind saying, we got to do this many cabbages, this many knee replacements to have a good year, and if we go above that, we've had a really good year, right? Is your alignment with helping people to health so they don't need cabbages? So we literally ran into this. Dean Ornish ran into it with his program. They would not go for his well evidence-based program because it actually was taking away from their cardiologists who have a lot of say inside the systems. It's a tough time. I actually went on a semi-sabbatical because I didn't like reporting out the challenges over and over again. So we were in an arena with perverse incentives for health, if you follow that. This is the question that began to percolate in me, which was, if there is big money in integration of these therapies and providers, the big money is in saving money. If there's big money. And then with that is then what's the incentive structure that makes that meaningful, right? Something's got to change for that to be something that's going to be moving a purchaser of any sort. In the middle of that environment, that era in 97, 98, Tom Harkin, then U.S. Senator, powerful guy in the Appropriations Committee, moved this little office of alternative medicine to becoming a center for complementary alternative medicine. This is the language, the first place where he says, this is what this center is going to do. It's a very strong health services agenda. He was living in that context. He knew that there are hospitals, employers, insurers who were making these decisions, and they had no data, or very little data, on which to make the decision. So set up the agency to do that, right? Let's look at these prevention, alternative treatment systems, modalities, and disciplines. It's not just therapies. It's not looking at an herb and what the mechanism of the herb is. And then we talk about the priorities for research and look at the priorities. Outcomes is number one. Health service is number three. Then only after that you get to basic science and clinical trials. And like I like to say, is I don't know about you, but if I've ever been one above other, you usually don't get much. At the NIH, they got 95% of the dollars at one and two above other. They didn't listen actually to Congress. And thus, the sad thing is, had they done that, imagine what we would know in terms of how to best use all of these therapies and providers and the actual delivery of care if we'd had those 11, whatever it is, the billions of dollars. I'm not sure what the total is for the time that we did. It's 1.4 or something like that. So, backdrop for this period, there were people who were realizing that things were getting out of control. Ever since Medicare came in, costs were way higher than anybody wanted. And interestingly enough, every time that there was an effort to move on that from the HMO Act to the Clinton reform, we were trying to engage another values system. We were trying to reverse the perverse incentives of the system through staff model, employee model, to having payment and delivery linked together in a classic HMO model. In that environment, maybe something could behave and work differently for us. At the same time, we were engaging this values shift, this realization that something has indeed gone wrong in our medical delivery industry. Unfortunately behaving as a capitalist entity, the money just moves towards, I like to say, capitalism loves an SUV. Capitalism loves anything that creates a higher margin, right? Massage therapist, how much money can you make off of $65, right? But if you're doing a procedure that's this big, you've got a higher margin on it. So it tends to move things into tertiary care, which is just the opposite way that you want to do with community health and public health. And we saw the downstream effects of it with Tara's Human first calling out how many deaths related to medical errors, how many too much challenges. And then, of course, the best people in medicine responded with crossing the quality chasm, Berwick's 100,000 Lives campaign. There have been some really good moves to try to take on that. But where we were left was this realization that, we have a cost that's roughly 2 times plus higher than anybody else. All these data, lower life expectancy. And in 2014, a team out of Harvard published information that guessing that the medical-related deaths are between 250,000 and 440,000. Side note editorial here, I think we've got to start talking about single-payer denialism, climate deniers. The evidence, if anybody wants to look at the evidence, suggests that an evidence-based system would be a single-payer-based system. So we need to shift these incentives, and indeed we've been working to do that through the advent of the triple aim, the concept of a values-based medical delivery. Those values move to a lot of things that were discovered in crossing the quality chasm. They also move towards a lot of the values set in integrative health and medicine. So as we move, we move towards team care. We move towards interprofessionalism. We move towards not discharge, but handoff, right? We move towards empowerment. We move energy out into communities, out into community health, public health, the whole Robert Wood Johnson thing that's going on I just went to. That's all part of that movement to invest differently and appreciate that if only 10 or 15% of the forces related to health are clinical, that we've got to appreciate the others. We'd asterisk that in an area that we don't really have any research on it, but I think it would be a great paper to come up with, which is if you actually have clinical practices that focus on the determinants of health that are related to lifestyle, right? If you're doing mind-body interventions, if you're doing diet interventions, if you're doing group work, as we've heard here, that 10 to 15% may bounce up to 30 or 35% that you can connect with if you're doing that. And then, of course, a very good integrative practitioner is thinking about connecting with community resources, is bringing a family in, is working with some of the other determinants that are there. So it's an interesting data point for all of us to be thinking about, but that 10 to 15 may not be correct for this community if it's operating at its maximum. In its maximum place. So this is Ken Paulus, who was running the Alina system at that time, gave me like the quote of quotes for this transition process. When he was first there in 2007, it was pre-Affordable Care Act, and he says, I looked at its integrative medicine, happened to have a huge philanthropic support from the former head of the Medtronic, the Georges, and so he had to look at it. They're major benefactors to the whole system. And he said, I looked at it and I thought, oh my God, this is an expense. It's just costing us. That's all it's going to be. It says, but as the Affordable Care Act kicks in, as values-based medicine kicks in, now I'm thinking, maybe these folks can be our friends, can be our assistants. And that's basically the postulate that I've got before you today, is that in many respects, It's a time to rethink the relationship to this integration process. That first confrontation was in a very adversarial, non-values-based environment where, frankly, this community does not generate much cash, right? So if you're about generating cash, about revenue, that room in that hospital has got awfully expensive for a massage therapist, or somebody who's doing mind-body work, or somebody who's spending an hour and a half in an integrative consult. But if you're moving towards health creation, it may be that that's actually a good use of that room to have any of those things going on there. So when this change made it through the integrator, my newsletter, I just got a hold of some of these people who are working in these environments to give me their perspectives. And this is Lori Knutson, who's actually at Ken Paulus' system there, but here's where she's beginning to see where the handles are, where the connection points are, is lowering costs, raising quality, lower side effects, perhaps better use with pain, and which we're seeing more and more since Lori said this. She specifically points out that if you can change the patient satisfaction in Medicare, the system's actually got an interest in that's financial now, that's beyond just helping their patients to better care. This is another guy from the Minnesota area. I happened to run into it at an interprofessional meeting and got to know him. But he, similar themes going through all of this. We're moving towards more holistic measures. The whole culture is beginning to reflect the culture that many of us embody and promote. And the focus on outcomes again. I don't have too many major regrets in life, but I sure wish we had 15 years of data where we'd actually done what Senator Harkin wanted us to do. Because look what we know about the outcomes of actually embedding these people in delivery organizations, in insurance coverage. This Tom Trumpeter is a close colleague of mine in the Seattle area with the HealthPoint network of FQHCs. And, he's talking about the chance that to actually now pick and choose from different types of providers on inside of global payment, the team approach, where is the value for an acupuncturist, for a massage therapist. And if you move into the interprofessional thinking where it's no longer kind of verticality, but it's actually horizontal respect for the value that every practitioner has, then you really begin to think about how these folks associated with traditional integrative practices may be useful. We then, in 2013, 2014, through ACAC, and then this project I'll be telling you about, we did two surveys to just actually get perceptions of people in these communities about felt alignment with the triple aim. And what you see here, there were slightly different language. The first one at the top was, there were 27 people who were running academic medical center-based integrative clinics. So these are basically all but one medical doctors who were interviewed. I'll go into detail in just a second here, but they were interviewed about their experience and whether anything's changing, because they'd had that externalized feeling that we're sitting out here. They're not too interested in us. We think we can create value, but it's hard to get their attention. So we were looking, asking them about, you know, what's happening. Is anything changing? The other was just at the biennial meeting of this consortium. And this was chiropractors, naturopathic doctors, massage therapists, acupuncturists alike. And you see this high level of alignment, and roughly 50% at a strongly alignment, that what we do is aligned with the triple aim goals of, right, enhancing patient care, lowering per capita costs, and bettering population outcomes. So we engaged this survey through this Project for Integrative Health and the Triple Aim, which I'll be getting into here. And I pulled together a team so we could access the people we wanted to survey in the academic health centers. Of Jeffrey Duzik is actually at Alina, and Melinda Ring is here at Northwestern, the Osher Center, Integrative Medicine Center here. And then that's Jennifer Oljezic, who is the project director for the PETA project. So you see, as I run through, that there's a set of 70 to 85% who have some level of agreement that they're getting more attention now, right? Around hospital admits here, then around, the plan's interest in lowering costs. Let me see where I am. I think I jumped here. They're generally getting more calls. There are more people who are connecting and saying, maybe you all can have some value to us. There's also a subset that's real of 40% or so that say we're actually getting more money from the system for what we're doing, and I think it's associated with that. We broke down and asked them a series of questions. I think the most interesting is the second one down there, that there are more specialty groups that are engaged in initiatives saying, hey, maybe those integrative medicine people might have some insight, something to contribute as we're trying to figure out how to respond to this situation. Very few have much hard evidence on the triple aim. I guess it's 43%, which is better than it could be. For you who are not aware, this is happening at a time where integrative health and medicine is in a variety of ways embedded in the Affordable Care Act, thanks to the lobbying of people like the Integrative Health Policy Consortium, the Chiropractic Associations was a major promoter of the non-discrimination bill. But it's an arrival point, that's happening at the same time. As we move to the values base, we actually have some presence for integrative health thinking. The realization that we really need to get after our cost issues has been strong, that even if you have clinical evidence of value, often you still can't get in the door unless you actually get cost, because the dollar does tend to rule a lot of decision processes. I just wanted to give kudos to a couple of the early efforts there. The Samueli Institute in Alexandria developed this wellness initiative for the nation that actually has some documentation behind it of the ways that we can not only be moving towards wellness, but we can save with better use of a variety of types of integrative services. The Brave World Collaborative, that's been a major funder of the development of integrative medicine in our academic health centers, put together this piece. It's kind of research light. It help you more with your friends or people who are on the border than it's going to help you convince somebody who's kind of an adversarial. There's an open question really about whether or not there's anything that convinces somebody who's adversarial. The next study that was very powerful, and I urge you to take a look at, all of these are inside of the PETA Project website, so I'll be sending you to a place where you can connect to them all, is this study that really did a full-blown lit survey to look at cost effectiveness. And it was David Eisenberg from Harvard and then Patricia Herman, who's now at RAND. And so you have that nice blessing from on high of institutional value. And I love this quote of Patricia's. This is from an interview I did with her afterwards in the Integrator. She says, Let's stop talking about there being no evidence, thank you. You know, there is evidence of cost effectiveness. Now let's move on to phase two and thinking about it, thinking about the applications, thinking about the replicability. Okay. This is a newer resource. If you go to the IHPC.org site, you'll come up with this study. I love the fact that they called it Health Creation Economics, but it was a more recent look at a project that actually Master University, I think, helped, your next speaker's from, has helped fund the creation of the booklet. But a great trio of writers, again, pulling together what's really a tool for going out into your communities and making the case for the value that you can have around cost. This project we began in 2013 with, frankly, a surprising investment from a family foundation, the Leo Guthman Fund, allowed us to begin it. And I want to tell you about the group that's behind it. The PETA project is this academic consortium for complementary alternative healthcare. Its base is the five sort of licensed CAM disciplines that have a federally recognized accrediting agency. So that's chiropractic, acupuncture, and oriental medicine, massage therapy, naturopathic medicine, and the direct entry midwives. You know, all total, it's about 380,000 licensed folks. We, early on, it was a power play, frankly, to get together, learning about each other, but realize that as a group, we might be able to enter into some regions and to some dialogues and to create some things that we couldn't do individually, and one of which was to create more philanthropic investment in what we were doing by knocking on the philanthropist door saying, hey, this isn't what we in massage want or we in chiropractic want. We've gotten together and collaboratively said this is our priority to do this, and we've been able to draw some capital to projects because of it. Its core members are the accrediting bodies, the councils of colleges, and the certifying bodies for all of those professions. That's its base. There are also about 60 individual colleges that are members. Basic idea was this, was it was looking at the values coming up in the triple aim and in the values-based system and then the off-spoken and articulated values of integrative health and medicine. And it's, you know, it's actually, if you look there and start the two bubbles there, you know, you see this respect for the whole person, trying to use less invasive things, the interprofessionalism in team care. You know, there's a values alignment potentially there that wasn't there in 95, right? There's a potential for alignment. That, if you go to optimalintegration.org, you will be able to call up the stuff that I'm now referring to. So we have as part of our advisory group to this Karen Melgate, who was a deputy director for strategy actually at CMS, working with us, which kind of was useful to have that blessing from on high, but also to get her insights. And she, you know, kind of indicated that these were areas that she thought. There's a whole webinar presentation on the site with Karen talking about that, where the complementary and alternative practices and providers might be useful in meeting some needs out there. This is a look at this the cost site on the PETA page there. But if you can see that the small print on the left side, it's all the different stakeholders. What we've done is we've aggregated cost studies by stakeholder group. So you can go in under insurance, you can go in under employer, you can go in under health systems and see a variety of studies that can help arm you or anybody else in making the case. As Patricia says, we don't have to talk about whether or not we have cost data. There are cost data out there. There are about 35 or something like that, or 40 studies that we have in this data set. We also have another site, so that's one piece of the triple aim is cost. We have the other piece about patient experience is also nicely built out. I don't have a picture of it, but it also is showing it's not just what patient experience means in a regular health system now. If you know, that's often, you know, what's your Were you able to park nearby? How long was your wait time? Did they treat you well? All of which is actually useful when you're a patient. But we have a more kind of integrative idea about what should be in that box, and then expand it to what is the actual patient experience of care like? What do we know about patient-reported outcomes? And so you'll find that kind of those kind of data in the studies that are referenced there. It's just a click away on the right-hand side of the PETA site. The other things that we're doing, again, our goal is to foster helping people get into this new dialogue that seems to be possible now. And to do that, part of it's data, part of it's best practices, who's doing what. So this, the list of clinics that are here are all either FQHCs that have some integrative services, and there are links often to articles about those, or they are actually patient-centered medical homes that are integrative. And we now have two projects that are funded with small grants to specifically report out. One of them is it's a partnership release with Casey Health Institute in Maryland that started from the ground up with philanthropic support to be a primary care health home that's fully integrated from the beginning. Fascinating what the work that they're doing there. It's a very nice body of providers. The other group is there are naturopathic physicians in Vermont and Oregon who under their state laws can run medical homes. In Vermont, they're actually joint commission reviewed. It's under the Oregon system in Oregon. So we're beginning to gather some of the experience data there. It's both to sort of teach their profession about what's going on, but to teach the rest of the world about the fact that there is this other model of care. So we worked in the context of philanthropic partnership and philanthropic investment, and these are, they range from 5,000 to about, 35,000 that went to the project. We've been, like so many things in these fields, kind of stitching together the support for our work. I'm not going to pause much on these, but just to give you a sense, of a couple of things of the studies that are out there. Their studies, or some of them are pretty, they'll stand scrutiny of somebody who's pretty darn critical. Others were pretty loose studies. This, happens inside of health systems, inside of insurance companies. We generate data that couldn't get you through to publication, but you actually use for your decision processes, and then people have reported them out for meetings. So, there's this findings that money is being saved with integrative services. At Ford Motor Company, for instance, medication use goes down 58% in this study. This Canada Post study, actually, that Patricia Herman was on, found this, 1,000 a year was saved on cardiovascular risk. Most of that actually through looking at the employer's interest in productivity indications. It's a very, for any of you wanting to make the case, that is a place where we make it very strongly, is around all of the issues related to what they call presenteeism. Any of you familiar with the term? No, but you think about all of the ways that mind-body acupuncture, relaxation can influence sleep, can influence gut issues, can influence anxiety, can influence depression. All of these things are just major sucks of energy outside of them for employers. So this is on the insurance side, and again, you see this pattern that actually it supports what people were saying in those hot tubs. So they weren't making stuff up, apparently. There's a pattern that we see in a lot of these studies, which is not surprising, that often the primary care cost, the care office visit cost, can actually be higher, but the imaging cost in particular is much lower, and then you will see often lower surgery costs, just exactly what the people in the hot tub said, right? Although they often didn't realize that they cost more in the office, but it should make sense. If we invest more in primary health care and community medicine, there'll be more money over there. but it'll have this other effect on what's downstream. This study just came out this month. Are any of you familiar with this out of the Benson Henry? I would have liked to have set this slide up to, yes, the slide up to say, you know, to make you guess. But this was, you know, Herbert Benson's work with relaxation response that's put into a programmatic format. They went back and looked at 4,000 patients there, compared them to sort of a matched controls, and found a 43% reduction in health services utilization. You know, the line in the cynical line inside of the integrative health field at a time like this is, if a drug did that? I mean, it's just amazing, right? I mean, why aren't we just jumping on board? Why aren't we just jumping on board? At least replicating it tomorrow, right? All over the country. Let's see 9 demonstration sites. There's really no good excuse for it. So here we are, 2015. I just want to give you these four quotes here because they suggest the extremity that our academic medicine leaders and our health care industry leaders are in. And that's opportunity because it all speaks to these new values that are coming up. So I'm through ACAC. I'm involved with this Institute of Medicine Global Forum on Innovation and Health Professional Education. Basically, all the health professions in the U.S. are there. There's actually global people involved in it. And we've been at it for about 3 years. This was from the last meeting in last spring. But, you know, they're talking transformation. His co-chair is talking about we need to break the box of what we do in academic medicine. There's this realization that what we're doing is just not meeting the needs of this shift towards actually creating health in our population and getting out of this cycle of feeding tertiary care. You know, I will tell you that there is this elephant in the room continuously, and that's economics. And it shows up as frank impotence in these meetings. We get right up to great idea, why aren't we doing it? Well, we aren't doing it because, frankly, the hospitals, tertiary care still runs everything. Our residencies are all run through hospitals. We can't move our residencies into the community. We can't change our RVRVUs to give more money to the primary care. We're at that economic place, which we wouldn't be at if, in fact, we were an evidence-based country that wasn't a single-payer denier. We would have a chance to actually look at all of this quite differently than we are right now. On the medical delivery side, you see, if you know Don Berwick, he's a hero of mine for going back to the Crossing the Quality Chasm, the 100,000 Lives campaign. He's just grabbed a hold of these things and said, you know, let's move on it. This is not going to gather dust. Let's make some change happen here. He, and in the end of 2013, spoke to the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in his regular keynote, and he spent the entire 45 minutes talking about the need to move to salutogenesis, to move to health creation, to move out of that other model. Interestingly enough for all of us is when he cited his mentors in his shifting, he cited Herbert Benson, he cited Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he most of us all cited the head of the Samueli Institute, Wayne Jonas. So let's pat ourselves a bit here. You know, our community is actually mentoring some of the best minds in regular medical delivery on where we need to go next. He has a question here. You know, it's more radical than we've imagined. Look at that open question, because that's the open question I invite all of you and all of us to move into. And it's put very specifically by the head of the American Hospital Association, who, as we see more and more often, for any of you who are reading like Hospitals and Health Networks, any of the major, there's increasing talk about there's sick care and there's production of services, and we need to move away towards health care, to actual health care. It shows up over and over again. It's the first sign, you know, that being conscious, noting the difference. But he's saying, you know, none of us understand the recipe of how to go there. And again, I would suggest this is where we all need to rise up at a level that none of us, frankly, have. It's intimidating to actually take it seriously, that maybe we need to help think about how do you do the right kind of whole systems research that we need to have to move this forward. How do we actually best pay for people, and how do we create the coalitions that will ship payment? How do we get involved in the stupidity of not having residencies in community medicine? You know, even if it's primary care medical doctors, it's in our interest, it's in the interest of health to be supporting that. How do we do that? We don't necessarily, we pat ourselves on the back often and say, boy, we have the answers, we're the thing. I think when it comes down to really saying, then how are we going to do it? What's the recipe? We've got a lot of work to do. But it is a values alignment. This is, I think, my penultimate slide here. And I invite you all to start doing this with your language. I've been working to do it as a writer and as I articulate. I stumbled even in this talk one time when I started to say healthcare system. I invite you all to work on your language. If something is behaving like a medical industry and churning procedures, call it a medical delivery organization. Call it a medical industry. Don't call it a healthcare system. It's not that. We've lost the meaning of health in our community by allowing that name to be applied to something that's not necessarily really dedicated there. One, it's a really good sick care system, and we all need that from time to time. And that's different than being a medical industry. But a really good sick care system, honor it for being a really good sick care system. And when it actually is a system for creating health, for bringing people to health, then salute it, commend it, support it, and call the healthcare system. But I invite you to do it, because I think that's part of what our transition is we need to be clear about what we're doing here. What is it that's moving us? What is the value set that's moving us? This is my last slide, and I felt like this was like manna from heaven when I encountered this. It was when we got involved with this global forum. It was based on two studies in 2010, which were literally, they were both studies that were consciously engaged to mark the centennial of Flexner, right? And among other things, you know, the Flexner report moved energy into tertiary care. It created a lot of consequences that have not been good for human health. And I'm not sure they're good things. I like science, actually. I like to analyze things. I like to know. That's why I ask people in hot tubs. That's all, you know, that's the only evidence base I had at the time. But it's important, but there were some adverse consequences. 100 years later, there were these two studies engaged. One of them was the Future of Nursing study, which was a major breakthrough, because it actually said that nurses working alone could do as good a job as medical doctors could, and it didn't matter if it was primary care or in anesthesiology. It broke down the hegemony of medical practice, basically, in the U.S., but it created the context of the interprofessional movement also. Big deal. The other one, though, was this Lancet report on looking at what do we need for the future of healthcare in our health profession and education. The board of ACAC, when it sent us there, it sent us with a charge. It was a cool board call. You know, you got when you're on a conference call, if you want to engage people, we do once around. You know, sorry, you can't just shut up. You have to get off mute and say something. So we said, so what would you think we should be focusing on in this dialogue at the IOM, which is costing us a lot of money to be there? And somebody said, you know, isn't the most important innovation to actually be educating healthcare professionals who are focusing on creating health, who are getting out of being reactive, you know, doing that when you need to, and by God, we all need that, but to really focus on what are all the strategies and structures to help create health in people in the communities that we serve. Isn't that the innovation we want to do? So we had that as a charge, and then went to the first, you know, started reading the materials that they gave us. That was our homework, was these two studies. And this was in the Lancet report about where we need to be and what we're educating. And if you look at the first line, was really sort of the Flexner era, you know, load them with information to become experts. Mid-century, it was really more, it was heavy guild development, professional development, helped to imbue them as part of that process. This, if you see the bottom line there, is, and this wasn't about leaders, this wasn't about a profession, this is about all health professions, that we need to have a type of learning that's transformative in its nature, that has the objective of instilling leadership attributes in people. For what purpose? To be change agents. And so it's an environment that's very comfortable to all of us who've been in this work for a while, believing that actually change agency is what it's all about. So I guess that was penultimate. I just wanted to say that one of the nice things that's going on is there are some programs coming up to help power up people's abilities to work in these environments. And for a long time, we've had the University of Arizona Fellowship. It's limited to nurses, DOs, MDs. AIHM, disclosure, I'm on their board, but we've worked very hard to create an interprofessional fellowship so you can actually take the fellowship with a body of people from nutritionists, acupuncturists, chiropractors, naturopathic doctors, medical doctors. You actually can sit for the specialty board. Those folks can't. The MDs who take it can sit for the specialty board as it's set up. But it's a whole new environment in a fellowship. And then the Duke program is really focusing on leadership, most around how to be a leader in a medical delivery organization to help move it towards becoming an actual system of health creation. So I think that that's the question for all of you. What role for yourself? What role for us?
Thanks, John, for that amazing tour. One of your last slides just gave me a moment of confusion. Like, you talked about kind of the distinction between a health creation system and a sick care system. And I'm always thinking, how do we integrate? How do we integrate this? You know, just looking at that dichotomy, just thinking about the power of perverse incentives. Is it really possible, or do we need two different systems, a sick care system and a health creation system?
So perhaps too easy of a response is, what if everybody who got a surgery, sick care, was powered up with pre-surgical mind-body work, and at the end of surgery, they were actually handed off to people who could help them with whatever it was that helped cause the condition that landed them there for the surgery, so that they wouldn't need to come back, and they definitely would have the least chance of needing to come back. You start embedding surgery in a healthcare system in that structure. I absolutely would not separate them. I think we have a cultural change we got to do. It's hearts and minds thing. And that's really what we've learned with all of it. The evidence doesn't do it. This is where the leadership work is key. We have to access and create champions. There's enough evidence to move on this. You know, in side note, in Oregon, the first time a jurisdiction has basically reversed the therapeutic order of the nation, as my friend Pamela and I, Snyder and I like to say, but with pain care. Medicaid is covering massage therapists, acupuncturists, naturopathic doctors, chiropractors, and they're literally trying to drive people away from opioid usage at the state level. First time it's happened. You know, that's another example of moving these services in. It's sick care. You're expanding it. We absolutely need to do it, you know, but we got to find the champions. We got to power up our abilities to connect.
One more question, or you can wait. Okay.
Yeah, very good.